this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the first headline across the top of the page, Cree in Major Expansion, Silicon North. Now, this article is written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Durham, and the article runs horizontally across the top of the page. On the far left, there's a picture inside the lab at Cree with the vice president, and the caption reads, Vice President Joe Biden on a visit to Cree in March 2010, and CEO Chuck Swoboda is also in the picture. Cree Incorporated is embarking on an expansion so big that it has its own name. Cree Silicon North. It will grow the company's Durham footprint by nearly 50% and could set off a hiring spree. The maker of energy-efficient LED lights has begun site work for construction of 400,850 square feet of light manufacturing plant and support buildings on 38 acres north of the company's headquarters at 4600 Silicon Drive, where Cree currently has nearly 1 million square feet. Site plans show 179,000 square feet of manufacturing space in a main building, 86,000 square feet of warehouse, and 40,000 square feet of office space. Side structures include 95,850 square feet of utilities, security posts, and storage, among others. Plans also call for about 400 parking spaces. The site is being prepared for construction, says Cree spokeswoman Michelle Murray, but details on hiring and estimated date of completion currently are unavailable. Murray also could not specify what will be manufactured in the new facility. We're still in the planning process for what the building will house and when it will be done, Murray says. While the company is mum on what will be produced, analysts have stressed the importance that the company improve its manufacturing so as to be able to fill orders without wait times. Also cited as important to the company's future is a ramp-up in production of cost-effective 150-millimeter wafers. Cree shares recently took a dip after the company revised down its fiscal year third-quarter revenue forecast by about 14%. The company blamed inventory corrections and accelerated pricing declines. Dale Pfau, an analyst with Cantor Fitzgerald, noted in a recent report the importance of Cree's manufacturing facilities in Durham to the company's competitive edge. The company manufactures all of its wafers and chips at a single facility in Durham, Pfau wrote. Disruption to this facility or the inability to execute on any of the aforementioned tasks could have a serious impact on the company's financial performance. Pfau also notes this week that the company maintains plans for $250 million in capital expenditures this year. Included in that is an implicit assumption to continue to increase capacity to meet the more than 30% annual growth in the worldwide market, Pfau says. We would assume that this new building is part of that overall plan. We would expect they would build a large building and then add manufacturing equipment as necessary to meet demand. Cree President and CEO Chuck Swoboda has said that one of the company's priorities is to further invest in capacity expansion to accelerate transition to the 150-millimeter wafers, and the company has increased research and development spending in recent quarters. The project is critical to reducing costs and maintaining our competitive edge in the market, he said. We continue to target the first 150-millimeter products to be qualified by the end of this fiscal year, with the first production volumes to start in early fiscal 2012. Silicon North is Cree's third wave of expansion in the Triangle in recent years. In 2010, Cree expanded its headquarters by purchasing a 60,000-square-foot building in Pinnacle Park Corporate Center on Silicon Drive. The company also announced plans in the fall of 2010 to invest $135 million in a new production line for silicon carbide wafers, which are used to make LED light bulbs. That expansion, projected to create 244 new jobs by 2013, was awarded $4.4 million in state and local incentives. By March, the company had finished renovating an existing facility and broken ground on a 47,500-square-foot plant for the new production line. Before that, in October 2009, Cree announced plans to hire 575 new employees by 2012. The company exceeded that hiring target within a year. It received no incentives for that expansion. Cree is not saying how much it's spending on Cree Silicon North or whether the company is seeking incentives for the expansion. Marquetta Welton, interim deputy county manager in Durham County, says the company is not receiving incentives from the county. Neither is it getting incentives from the city of Durham. The company could still seek state incentives through the North Carolina Department of Commerce. Cree's revenue for the second quarter was $257 million, down 4% sequentially, but up 29% year over year. Cree's third quarter earnings for fiscal year 2011 will be out April 19. And moving to the center of the page, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, there's an article with a black border around it. Inside that border, first on the right half of it, there's a picture of the corner, the rounded corner of a building. And the caption reads, "Only 11 of 56 condos have been sold at Bloomsbury Estates." And then on the left side, there's first the headline in bold black lettering, and then below that the article. The headline, "Condos Given a Reprieve, Bloomsbury Hearing Postponed by Bank." Now, this article was written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with a dateline of Raleigh. The developer of the Bloomsbury Estates condominium building have been given a temporary reprieve as Fifth Third Bank has postponed a foreclosure hearing that was scheduled for April 14. Raleigh lawyer Barry Mann, who is serving as substitute trustee for the property, confirmed on April 13 that the bank's foreclosure hearing for Bloomsbury Estates had been postponed and that a new date had not yet been set. Mann said he did not know why the hearing was postponed. Bloomsbury so far has sold 11 of 56 residential units available since the seven-story structure opened in late 2009. Unit prices have ranged from $240,000 for smaller units to $900,000 for the penthouse suite, with a clear view of downtown Raleigh's skyline from the corner of Boylan Avenue and Hargett Street. Alan Tate, real estate agent, Mike Richmond, has 12 of Bloomsbury Estates' remaining units listed on the regional multiple listing service for homes available for sale, but he says he's also marketing the other 33 units that are still vacant. Richmond referred questions to Bloomsbury developer John Brockell of Raleigh, but Brockell did not respond to repeated calls for comment. An investor in the project, retired R.J. Reynolds tobacco executive David Aoko, says the partners are working through their issues with the bank. "It's been a difficult time in the past 2 years," Aoko said in a phone interview from his home in Daniel Island, South Carolina. "It's a good project, and we believe it's the highest quality project. In the end, it will all work out." Brockell worked out a 2-year plan with Fifth Third Bank in June 2010 to pay off the balance of his $17.8 million loan, which stood at around $12.3 million in early 2010. Sales have remained slow since then. A spokesman for Cincinnati, Ohio-based Fifth Third Bank did not have any additional details about the pending foreclosure for Bloomsbury Estates. Bloomsbury resident Joe Soto, who purchased the seventh floor unit in September, says he has heard nothing about a possible foreclosure of the property. "I talk to the banks all the time, and they've been telling me they are pleased with the way things are going," Soto says. On a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being their most concerned, they said Bloomsbury was a 1 or a 2. A second nearly identical building to the existing Second Empire-style Bloomsbury building remains on the drawing board. And as we move just to the right of that article, still on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, we have an article that runs vertically along the right side of the page. The headline, "Advisors Build Halls to $19 Billion." And then under that's the article. Underneath the article, there's a picture of a man wearing a tie, sitting at his desk, three computers in the background. The caption reads, "Himanshu Shah Helms Shah Capital." And this was written by Lee Weisbecker with a dateline of Raleigh. Four of the region's five largest investment firms added to their total money under management over the past year and now oversee a combined $18.7 billion, according to federal filings. Raleigh-based Shah Capital, a domestic and overseas stock investor headed by Himanshu Shah, experienced the largest percentage gain, 18.1%. Money under management at Shah rose from $276 million in March 2010 to $326 million as of March 2011. Although the gain is respectable, throughout most of 2010, we have been very cautious and have invested accordingly, says Shah Capital spokesman Richard Callahan. And as a result of the cautious approach we took last year, we believe we are well positioned for moving ahead in 2011. The money under management numbers come from investment advisory firm filings maintained by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. The information is updated only once a year. And as a measure of a fund's status, the data serve as a basic yardstick that gives insight into both investment returns and losses and the entry and exit of investors, explains Chapel Hill wealth manager Charles Leedy. Seeing a decline in assets over the 12-month period was Durham-based fixed income manager Smith Breeden. The firm reported about $6.5 billion under management as of the end of March, down by 21% from $8.2 billion in 2010. The drop can be linked to the continued travails in the U.S. mortgage market, in which Smith Breeden has been heavily invested. Back in 2007, before the financial crisis and widespread problems centering on mortgage-backed securities, Smith Breeden had $32 billion under management. Meanwhile, in Chapel Hill, Morgan Creek Capital, the investment business set up by former UNC Chapel Hill endowment manager Mark Yusko, saw assets under management rise by 2% to $9.2 billion as of March 2011. In a recent interview, Yusko said he expects his asset under management to bounce back toward the firm's high water mark of $10 billion when some new funds begin drawing cash from investors and can be counted in the company's asset totals. Yusko recently filed documents stating that one new fund, Morgan Creek Asia Partners, had raised $214 million of a $250 million target. Also in Chapel Hill, convertible arbitrage specialist Silverback Asset Management reported an 8.4% rise in money under management during the past 12 months, from $553 million in 2010 to $600 million in 2011. Franklin Street Advisors, a wealth management and hedge operation, reported 2011 assets of $2.03 billion, up 2.7% over the $1.98 billion the firm reported a year earlier. And we have one last article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal. This article runs horizontally across the bottom of the page. The headline, Access to Med Records of All May Be in Offing in North Carolina. And on the far left side of this article, there's a picture of a man wearing a suit and tie. The caption reads, Wake Med's Bill Atkinson favors records legislation. And then also there's, within the article, a small face picture only of State Senator Josh Steen, a Raleigh Democrat. This article was written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. Doctors from Manio to Murphy soon could have access to electronic medical records of all state residents, something supporters say could save lives. The state Senate has passed a bill in a 49-0 vote that would create a database with every state resident's medical records. The legislation is awaiting House approval. If enacted, the law would be funded with a $13 million federal grant that would be used to build a server that medical groups around the state could access. To cover continuing costs, hospitals would pay an annual fee to participate in the exchange. Participation rates have not been decided, but hospital leaders do not anticipate it being cost prohibitive. The purpose is to improve communications among providers, to improve the quality of health care delivery, and to lower the cost of health care, says State Senator Josh Steen, a Raleigh Democrat. The legislation has widespread support from doctors and hospitals. If someone is on vacation away from home and has an accident, an emergency room doctor could pull the person's full medical history and have a better idea of treatment, according to proponents of the bill. In addition, a person's primary care physician could see what other specialists might have been seen and get a fuller picture of a person's medical history. I just think it's a matter of life-saving and limb-saving priority that information should be readily available, says Bill Atkinson, president of WakeMed Health and Hospitals. Eventually, I hope it goes nationwide. For older adults who receive multiple treatments, the information exchange would help doctors know which tests have already been completed, which could result in savings, says Novlet Bradshaw, vice president and chief information officer at Rex Healthcare, part of UNC Healthcare. We're excited about this, she says. This is really needed, especially from a patient's perspective. Doctors and hospitals already keep detailed electronic histories of their patients. They just don't have a good way of sharing that information, especially statewide. In some cases, a physician will fax a printout to a specialist who requests a medical history. I suspect it will not be a whole lot of cost, Bradshaw says. Furthermore, she says it would likely result in an overall savings for the hospitals. The network would be as secure as possible, Stein says, to maximize protection against identity theft. Though, as with all things, Stein says he could not guarantee complete privacy because of the nature of the record keeping. For that reason, there will be a clause for patients to opt out of the program if they do not want their medical information shared on the network. It would be heavily protected and secure, assures Linwood Jones, general counsel with the North Carolina Hospital Association. In Atkinson's opinion, patients would be foolish not to allow a doctor to share patient medical history with another doctor, and points out that many of the current forms of sharing information, think the fax machine, are far less secure than the electronic system would be. You have the ability to see your own records from wherever they come from, so you get to check over your own records, Atkinson says, adding that information is key. Anytime you're dealing with something as important as your own personal health, you control your own data. Atkinson, who serves on the board of directors of the North Carolina Health Information Exchange, says, many hospital systems with more than one campus already use secure networks to transfer data, and the proposed statewide system would act in a similar but much larger fashion. Stein calls it a backbone that would allow individual systems to communicate with each other. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, Policy Bypassed, Sloan Still Chair of Highwoods. O. Temple Sloan Jr. has served as chairman of Highwoods Properties Board of Directors ever since the Raleigh Real Estate Company went public in 1994, and Highwoods board members aren't going to let their own policy guidelines get in the way of keeping Sloan in the chairman's seat for a few years more. The Highwoods board policy recommends that a director offer to resign at the end of the term after his 72nd birthday, a birthday that Sloan celebrated last year. Then the Compensation and Governance Committee, of which Sloan is one of two members, decides whether to reject or accept the resignation and offers its recommendation to the full board. In Highwood's proxy statement issued prior to its May 12 annual meeting of stockholders, the company disclosed that Sloan had offered to retire and that the board declined his offer. Instead, it recommended Sloan's re-election to the board, citing his expertise in real estate, finance, capital markets, and strategic transactions, among other qualifications. Sloan is the first director to test the guideline, says Highwood spokeswoman Tabitha Zane. Sloan is a busy man. Besides his work at Highwoods, he's chairman of General Parts International Incorporated and Trail Creek Investments Incorporated. He is also the lead independent director of Lowe's Companies Incorporated, is a director of Golden Corral Corporation, and serves on the National Executive Board of the Boy Scouts of America. Highwoods shareholders will vote on the election of seven directors at its May 12 annual meeting in Raleigh. Apartment properties are a hot investment sector right now in the Triangle, and owners of the Blount Street Commons development in the center of downtown Raleigh hope that strong interest will turn into a big sale for a 2.3-acre parcel zoned for a mid-rise multifamily building. Blount Street Commons owner LNR Property is trying to sell the former parking lot property on Wilmington Street across from the North Carolina Department of Revenue building to an investor or development group. According to a proposal that the C.B. Richard Ellis real estate firm is circulating, the formerly state-owned property has been conceptually designed for 186 units, but density up to 495 units could be achieved by transferring units from other parts of the Blount Street Commons property. The proposal didn't list a price for the land, but Wake County tax records value the site at $2.4 million. The closing of the Chesterfield building, the last undeveloped piece of the West Village mixed-use campus in downtown Durham, has been delayed from April to May. Joshua Parker, head of Chesterfield Partners, the developer of the property, says the delay is the result of a confluence of events. The team has moved a $63 million bond deal that will largely fund the project from Stone & Youngberg to Guggenheim Partners. which advised them that the market could yield a more favorable long-term interest rate after tax season. The Chesterfield project is on track to close by the end of spring, Parker said in an email. We are working with the existing building owner on a revision to the purchase agreement, and the bonds will be available to begin construction upon the final close when that is complete. Parker and Chesterfield Partners became the developers of the building in October after Blue Devil Partners, the original developers of West Village, led by former Duke University basketball star Christian Laettner, lost the building to creditors. Parker plans to convert the one-time Leggett and Myers factory into 152 apartments, 50,000 square feet of office, and 10,000 square feet of retail space. IBM is putting about $2.1 million into its Research Triangle Park campus to renovate and replace some space and equipment. According to building permits, IBM is putting in a commercial addition costing $1.3 million and a 3,600-square-foot alteration costing $768,000. When asked what the expansion and renovation are for, IBM spokeswoman Tina Wilson said the company is not building anything new. We're replacing an old piece of equipment with a new piece of equipment, and we're renovating a lab, she says. Experience the might of our armed forces during the weekend of April 16 to 17 as Seymour Johnson Air Force Base in Goldsboro puts on what the post commanders call an extraordinary air show. The event, which is free, will feature an assembly of air power and performers, including the Air Force Thunderbirds, Seymour Johnson's F-15E Strike Eagle Team, the U.S. Army's Golden Knights Parachute Team, the F-22 Raptor, a Tora 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 World War II reenactment, the MiG-17, F-4, A-10, P-51, and much more. While admission is free, Seymour Johnson personnel will be collecting donated canned food items for distribution in conjunction with the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Local entrepreneur Matthew Mahler of Tierra Ideas has hit upon an interesting business idea. He manufactures women's purses out of recycled aircraft materials, such as old seat covers, and now you can see the fruits of his labor at Hartsfield-Jackson Atlanta International Airport. Starting April 18, the airport will feature a recycle runway exhibition that includes one of Mahler's creations. Check it out the next time you have a layover or on a connecting flight, if you can find it in that maze of an airport. It has been 20 years since Raleigh businessman Roddy Jones handpicked his protege, Greg Sanchez, to take over Tri Properties of Durham, the leasing and property management company that was created in the restructuring of the Jones family real estate operations. In celebration of the 20-year milestone, Tri Properties invited more than 285 of its employees, clients, and friends to a big shindig at the Pavilion at the Angus Barn in April 8. The party was complete with beach music legends The Embers on stage, and Angus Barn chef Walter Royal's baby back pork ribs, aged Angus steak kebabs, and classic cheese grits, not to mention the open bar. The all-inclusive party was a rarity in these days of frugal spending among most real estate firms, but Sanchez says they felt they had reason to celebrate. Speaking of parties, a much younger Raleigh company, Springleaf Strategies, is celebrating its third anniversary with a month-long Facebook party. Consider it a virtual party with contest prizes and even a little cake. Springleaf Strategies, which is run by marketing and communication strategists Evelyn Contre, Catherine Nicholson, and Lindsay Warhurst, will be giving away a golden ticket at the end of the month to their biggest fans and party participants on Facebook and Twitter. Details about the golden ticket have yet to be disclosed. How often do you hear a band give a shout out to dear old dad while on stage? Jack Daniels, sure, groupies, oh yeah, but dad? Not very often. Kudos then to the Avett brothers, who took a break from performing to give their pop some verbal props in a show in Charlotte on April 9, drawing applause from the audience. Home did have to be on the band's mind since core members Scott and Seth Avett are natives of Concord, which is right down the road from the Queen City. Still, Biz couldn't help but smile at the familial aside. Speaking of that concert, the real highlight of the night, aside from lots of great music, of course, came from opening act Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. Put it this way, have you ever seen a grown woman in a short skirt jump up and down to the rhythm of a torridly paced song for 3 minutes straight while wearing stiletto high heels and manage to not break her ankles? Neither had Biz, until Grace did. Contributing to Biz were staffers Amanda Jones-Hoyle, Chris Basden, Monica Chen, and Jason DeBrun. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to, Firms Queue Up to Land NCSU Project. And this article is written by Amanda Jones-Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. And on the far right side of this article, there's a picture of the bell tower, looking from the ground, looking up at it with the sky as a background. The caption reads, "Property is across from the NCSU bell tower." Private developer groups from Raleigh, Charlotte, Atlanta, and Chicago will compete for a chance to reinvent a section of property across from NC State University's iconic bell tower on Hillsborough Street. A request for qualifications issued by the university in December caught the attention of 10 developer groups from across the country, and each will have until June 10 to come up with a plan and a proposal for the partially developed sites totaling 1.8 acres owned by University Endowment Fund. The university is considering options to sell or lease the land for future development, and a deal with the chosen developer would be finalized as early as August. It may not seem like a lot of land, but NC State's Director of University Real Estate, Ralph Retchie, says there may be additional assemblage opportunities for privately owned properties that are contiguous to the sites. A bigger site could accommodate a dense commercial project with a mix of commercial, retail, and residential uses to serve the university's students, faculty, and staff, as well as businesses along Hillsborough Street. "He told us to be creative, be bold," says Steve Johnson, senior vice president of the John S. Clark Company construction firm, who attended an April 11 site visit hosted by Retchie. "But you've got to have a plan A and a plan B, since not all property in question is owned by the university." The developer groups chosen to advance in the university selection process are Bellevue Partners of Raleigh, led by principals associated with veteran real estate investors and developers Arthur Sandman and his son Michael Sandman. They already own several properties along Hillsborough Street. Brody Company Incorporated of Greenville, which developed the $200 million Mayfair mixed-use project in Wilmington and owns several retail properties across eastern North Carolina. Concord Eastridge of Arlington, Virginia, which is the firm chosen by NC State to develop a planned conference center and hotel on Centennial Campus. It also is a partner with Empire Properties of Raleigh in its L-building development plans in downtown Raleigh. Gateway Development of Atlanta, which has built commercial projects adjacent to Georgia Tech's campus in Atlanta. John S. Clark Company of Mount Airy, which is a construction company that is planning to team with a regional developer if chosen. Keystone Corporation of Raleigh, led by veteran local developer Pat Gavigan, who built the Keystone Park office, Flex and Industrial Building on Davis Drive in Morrisville, as well as the Keystone Centennial Science Center building that opened on Centennial Campus in 2010. Sora Holdings, LLC of Towson, Maryland, and Sewell, New Jersey, which specializes in downtown redevelopment and college campus development projects. Vermilion Development of Chicago, Illinois, which is building a 1.1 million square foot mixed-use project in Chicago's Hyde Park neighborhood in partnership with the University of Chicago and the City of Chicago. White Oak Properties Incorporated of Raleigh, led by Roland Gammon, who has built single-family and multifamily projects in more than a dozen communities in Raleigh, in Cary, and in Chapel Hill. Mac Reese, a founding principal of Gateway Development of Atlanta, says although his firm has never developed a project in North Carolina, it has built large office and retail projects on and around university campuses. I don't understand at this point what NC State and Raleigh and the people on Hillsborough Street really want, but we've done enough of these projects to know that universities are great demand drivers for real estate space, Reese says. It was intriguing enough for us to submit our qualifications and begin putting together a proposal for June. The properties include vacant parcels abutting the new Hillsborough Street roundabouts. Now, our next article, it's in the center of page 3, has a black border around it. Inside that border, the top half is a picture of some people working at work in lab coats in a lab that's attached to a greenhouse with large plants growing in the back. The caption reads, Syngenta researchers take plants from greenhouse to lab in RTP. And then under that, there's the headline in bold black lettering, Syngenta Rising Crop Science Company aims for big expansion in RTP. And this article was written by Monica Chen with the Dateline of Durham. Syngenta Biotechnology is planning to construct a new building in Research Triangle Park that would increase the company's space in the park by 73%. The company has filed plans to build a 147,290-square-foot structure at 9 Davis Drive, with a greenhouse, support labs, office, and utility plant. Executives at Syngenta Biotechnology, which is the biotech division of Basel, Switzerland-based global crop protection company Syngenta, are waiting a final corporate decision to begin construction. The company is merely seeking approvals for permits now so that if the project is approved by Syngenta, we will be ready to move forward, says spokesman Steve Goldsmith, who declined to discuss potential hiring. Syngenta is a longtime tenant of RTP, having opened in the park in 1984 and grown in stages over the years. The company currently employs about 400 people in RTP and operates out of 200,000 square feet at its main campus, 3054 East Cornwallis Road. For the potential expansion, the company in 2009 bought 50 acres at 9 Davis Drive, which neighbors Syngenta's Cornwallis Road site, and demolished an existing 131,262-square-foot building. That structure had been used for manufacturing denim textiles and then later converted into office space for IBM. Big Blue moved out of the building in 2006. While awaiting a decision on the expansion, Syngenta in June 2010 leased 100,000 square feet of interim office space in Keystone Office Park in Durham. Most recently, the company filed plans to replace a steam generator in 500 square feet at its Cornwallis Road site. Syngenta's RTP operations pertain to research and development on insect and herbicide-resistant crops, water-optimized seeds, and seeds that enhance biofuel processing. Those businesses are expected to continue to grow for the Swiss parent company in the coming years. The company is still making investments in R&D, but with a tight rein on costs. We believe that we can accomplish the strategic objectives with targeting R&D between 9% and 10% of sales, said CEO Michael Mack during the company's fourth quarter 2010 earnings call. This is the fourth cost savings program the company has undertaken since we reformed now more than 10 years ago, and we've got a great track record. Syngenta's global revenue in crop protection and seeds has continued to grow in recent years. The company posted $8.9 billion in revenue for crop protection in 2010, up by 4.6% from 2009. For the seeds business, Syngenta posted $2.8 billion in revenue for 2010, up by 9.4% from 2009. Martin Fluckiger, an analyst with Swiss brokerage firm Helvia, expect Syngenta's business to continue to grow in 2011. The company will announce first quarter 2011 earnings in mid-April. Fluckiger forecasts a growth of 16% in sales volumes for the first quarter, driven by a 12% increase in crop protection revenue and an 18% increase in the seeds business. If weather conditions in the upcoming growing season in the Northern Hemisphere should turn out less than ideal, thus keeping yields relatively low, Fluckiger writes, we believe that global agricultural markets may even see a further tightening of the supply-demand balance, which would keep farmers' cash margins and thus demand for crop protection and high-value seeds at historically very high levels. Scientists with Syngenta and RTP have been developing a technology called Sugar Booster, aimed at boosting the sugar levels in sugarcane, the primary ethanol feedstock in Brazil and other countries. The company expects to launch Pleen, a sugarcane product in Brazil this year, with expected peak sales at $500 million, according to Flückiger. WUNC would feel pinch, not disaster, if feds cut funding. And that's the headline on our next article, written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. And next to the article, there's a picture of a woman in business attire standing outside the front door of WUNC-FM. The caption reads, Connie Walker heads up WUNC-FM. As if a down economy and general philanthropic malaise weren't bad enough, local affiliates of National Public Radio, or NPR, have had to deflect a national scandal and prepare for the potential loss of federal funding. Leaders of WUNC Radio, the local NPR station, whose signal blankets North Carolina from the coast to Greensboro, are bracing for the worst. We've definitely heard some things from listeners, says Connie Walker, the station's general manager. There are a few people who have pulled their funding. Republicans in Congress already had their eye on NPR funding when an NPR official was caught on video making disparaging comments about the GOP. That intensified the mood to take the axe to the NPR budget. WUNC receives about $500,000 annually from the federal government, an amount that represents about 7% to 8% of the station's annual budget. This year, the station received a federal appropriation of $530,000 toward its $7.2 million budget. Donations make up most of the rest. While a federal cut would hurt, it would not be devastating, especially now that the economy is slowly improving. Already, some regular donors who had pulled their funding have started sending checks again, and some even have pledged more donations because of the possibility of a cut or loss of federal funding, Walker says. The station has been fortunate over the years to have very generous private supporters, says Michael Schoenfeld, chairman of the WUNC Community Advisory Board. No question that public radio is really important to this region. On Capitol Hill, House Republicans made cuts to NPR stations in their proposed budget, but U.S. Senator Kay Hagan, Democrat, North Carolina, says any cuts would have to be bipartisan, adding that, "We are going to have to make tough decisions." If any federal cuts to WUNC's budget can't be covered through donations or other means, the station would feel the impact, says Walker and Schoenfeld. It makes the difference between a decent local service and a very good service, says Schoenfeld, Duke University's vice president for public affairs. In the 1990s, Schoenfeld worked as a senior vice president for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and saw NPR on a chopping block then as well. I lived through these wars before, he says. People in this region have a passion for public radio, but we hope we don't have to test it by making up $500,000 or more. A federal funding cut would be tough to maintain everything that we are doing, says Walker. We've nipped and tucked already. And our next article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Raleigh. The headline, PETA blasts animal research at UNC Duke in ad campaign. And above the article, there is a picture from the ad campaign. The picture, the caption reads, these posters are being distributed to students on campuses. And the poster is first on the left side, a close-up shot of a monkey's face looking through some bars, like a waffle bars. A metal, of course. And then next to that, there's a quote that says, if you call it medical research, you can get away with murder. And then under that, it says, experiments on animals. And then in white lettering with a red background, it has, switch to a better way. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has launched an advertising campaign in the Triangle that specifically targets the use of animals for research studies at UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University. The group has purchased space on a US 15501 billboard near Cornwallis Road with the picture of an animal and the message, if you call it medical research, you can get away with murder. Additionally, PETA has sent out 1,500 posters that students will distribute on campus. Postcards will be sent to the neighbors of researchers at the universities just so people are aware of who lives in their neighborhood, says Kathy Guillermo, Vice President of Laboratory Investigations for PETA. A Duke University spokesman declined to comment. Robert Lohman, Associate Vice Chancellor for Research at UNC Chapel Hill, says complaints about animal research are not new. About a decade ago, he says, PETA raised many of the same issues, and UNC took those concerns seriously. Since then, the university has worked diligently to significantly strengthen the animal care program and resolve any known deficiencies as quickly as possible, a practice that we pledge to continue, Lohman says. We have admitted mistakes when we found them, and we made the necessary corrections to meet or exceed the standards of full compliance with federal regulations. Since 2002, for example, the university has improved policies on caged animals, the timeliness of veterinary care, and euthanasia procedures. Moreover, researchers argue that their work leads to medical breakthroughs for humans, an ultimate benefit. To PETA, it's not enough. It's nonsense and it doesn't matter, says Guillermo. It doesn't really matter what the goal is when it comes to this type of suffering. Whatever lofty kind of wording is used by experimenters, it comes down to the fact that animals are suffering and dying. PETA estimates that the universities received a combined $821 million in public money in 2010, and that went toward research on animals. Of work being done at Duke, PETA has this on its website. More than $1.4 million has already been spent on pointless xenotransplantation experiments in which pigs are killed so that experimenters can try in vain to implant their hearts and lungs into baboons. Despite repeated failures, Duke University has wasted decades of time and tens of millions of dollars pursuing this road to nowhere. Of such work, Guillermo says, it's curiosity-based experimentation, and it means a lifetime of misery for an animal. UNC stands by its research policies. In 2008, the Association for Assessment and Accreditation of Laboratory Animal Care reviewed UNC's program and affirmed full accreditation. Additionally, Lohman says the university follows the policies and guidelines of the National Institutes of Health Office of Laboratory Animal Welfare. NIH's last report said that our corrective actions were appropriate and responsive. USDA says $35 million guarantee conditional for clean burn. Syndicate of 15 banks lent $66 million for firm that's now bankrupt. And that's the headline on the next article written by Lee Weisbecker with a Dateline of Raleigh. Whether a syndicate of 15 banks, some in the Triangle, that supported the state's only and now idle ethanol manufacturing plant will benefit from $35 million in federal loan guarantees remains an open question as Clean Burn Fuels Incorporated enters bankruptcy reorganization. The U.S. Department of Agriculture approved the guarantees back in 2007 in connection with the construction by Clean Burn Fuels of a corn-based ethanol plant near Rayford. USDA spokeswoman Delaine Johnson now says the guarantees were conditional and intended to be part of the permanent financing of an ethanol facility making 60 million gallons a year. While the financial provisions are still in place, Johnson added in response to a question, no guarantees have been issued and will not be issued until all conditions are met. Citing the rising costs of corn, Clean Burn shut down production at the facility in March and filed for Chapter 11 reorganization in April, claiming $80 million, mostly hard assets, buildings and land, and debts of roughly $80 million. The largest creditor is Dunn-based Cape Fear Farm Credit, which led a banking syndicate that pumped $66 million into the project. Locally, Raleigh-based Capital Bank, Durham-based KeySource Bank and Hampton Roads, Virginia-based Gateway Bank took part in the deal. USDA's conditional guarantees were approved in the name of Cape Fear Farm Credit to cover possible losses on at least a part of the bank package. Some $25 million of the guarantees were made from USDA's Rural Development Program, with the remaining $10 million coming from the Rural Energy for America program. Other than saying he is aware of the USDA's position on the guarantees, Cape Fear Farm Credit interim CEO Michael Jackson declined to discuss the matter or how it might play out in the coming bankruptcy case. I really can't talk about it, he said. Clean Burn officials have said they hope to emerge from Chapter 11 with a new financing plan that would be helped along by a moderation of corn prices following the fall harvest. If the company is not able to come up with a new plan, it would enter Chapter 7 liquidation, apparently without the USDA guarantees in hand, in place. Launched in 2005, Clean Burn started producing ethanol in August 2010 and had only recently ramped up its daily output to nearly 163,000 gallons by the time of the shutdown. At that level of production, the plant would turn out roughly 59.3 million gallons if it ran 7 days a week. Ethanol is mixed with gasoline to run cars and other vehicles. Clean Burn Fuels Chapter 11 restructuring officer Ed Sands of Anderson, Bauman, Tortelot, Voss, and Company in Charlotte says, to his understanding, the USDA loan guarantees will be extended if Clean Burn is able successfully to emerge from Chapter 11. In liquidation, he confirmed, the guarantees would not apply. Hotel, meal tax kitty running dry. Leaders say not to worry. That's the headline on this next article written by Chris Basden with the Dateline of Raleigh. Unless members of the Wake County Board of Commissioners and the Raleigh City Council take action, the fund balance for the hotel and meals tax will go negative in 2014 and stay that way until 2021. A recent financial review headed by Wake County Manager David Cook and Raleigh City Manager Russell Allen found that revenue from occupancy taxes and food and beverage taxes will total $35.6 million in 2014. But the total uses pledged to recipients clocks in at $36.1 million in that year. Even after accounting for a small beginning fund balance of $279,000, the ending fund balance would still be $197,000 in the red. The negative fund balance would continue to grow until it hits nearly $2.5 million in 2021 before going back in the black the next year. We know if we don't make any changes between now and 2014, we've got a problem, says Cook, who adds that there is still plenty of time to take action. Allen downplays the dilemma, saying, it's a very conservative model and projection, and we've got multiple options to remedy any shortfalls. The impending shortfall is being caused in part by the recession and its aftermath, which belted revenue streams. The occupancy tax generated $14.7 million in 2008 before falling to $13.5 million in 2009 and $13 million in 2010. The food and beverage tax also was impacted, with revenue declining slightly from $17.6 million in 2009 down to $17.3 million last year. A continued economic rebound could cause tax revenue to grow enough to erase the potential negative balance. If that doesn't happen, local elected officials will face hard choices, including whether or not to defer or change current obligations to recipients such as the RBC Center, the North Carolina Museum of Art, and St. Augustine's College. The problem also could ignite a fight over how much tax money should be flowing into the Raleigh Convention Center. Understanding why requires a brief primer on how the hotel and meals tax money is used. Picture those funds flowing in three pots to cover expenses. The first is a priority pot that includes everything from administration and collection of the taxes to earmarks for local governments to debt service allocations for facilities like the RBC Center and Five County Stadium. That pot will receive about $16 million in fiscal 2011. A whopping 85% of what's left over after filling that priority pot goes to the Raleigh Convention Center, a projected $13.6 million in fiscal 2011. The remaining 15% flows into the smallest pot of all, which funds discretionary projects like the Museum of Art, St. Augs, and capital improvements at the RBC Center. By design, the convention center doesn't spend all of the money it receives every year. One reason is because the center is supposed to maintain a balance sufficient to cover at least 1 year's worth of debt service payments, which helps keep the city's bond rating at a high level. The convention center is slated to make nearly $10.7 million in debt service payments in fiscal 2011. Even so, the ending fund balance in the center's tax pot is projected to total more than $33 million. Local elected officials could transfer some of that convention center money to fix the overall negative balance. Or they could elect to make an even more fundamental change to the building's allocation formula. At one point in the financial review process, Cook floated a proposal that included decreasing the convention center's take from 85% down to 82% in fiscal 2012. He also had recommended a further reduction from 82% down to 65% starting in fiscal 2020. Cook's proposal ran into opposition from city officials who argued that it's too soon to make such big changes to the funding model of the convention center, which opened in September 2008. For now, Cook and Allen are recommending that the elected officials punt on a decision regarding any alterations to the convention center financing plan until more information can be gathered. They recommend that another collaborative financial review be conducted between December 2011 and March 2012. And with our remaining time, we'll turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here are some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Cisco scuttling flip camera business. Cisco Systems Incorporated is shutting down its flip cameras business and expects to lay off 550 workers in the fourth quarter, the global networking company announced Tuesday morning. Details of how the closure might impact the company's workforce in Research Triangle Park, where it employs about 4,900 people, including contractors, were not immediately available. "We're not breaking out the locations of those 550 employees," says Karen Tillman, a spokeswoman for Cisco. San Jose, California-based Cisco, CSCO on NASDAQ, said it plans to realign consumer businesses to support priorities in core routing, switching, and services, collaboration, architectures, and video. Durham firm gets piece of $40 million fiber work. MCNC has awarded three contracts valued at $40 million to companies for the construction of 1,200 miles of high-speed fiber optics for the second phase of the expansion of the North Carolina Research and Education Network, or NCREN. The expansion of NCREN, called the Golden Leaf Rural Broadband Initiative, has an estimated total cost of about $146 million. The second phase is four times larger than the first phase and is expected to be completed by July 2013. The selected firms are Durham's Globe Communications, Loganville, Georgia-based Fiber Technologies, and Columbia, South Carolina-based Edward Telecommunications. Progress Energy to buy power from Florida Solar Farm. Progress Energy Florida, which is owned by Raleigh-based Progress Energy, New York Stock Exchange symbol PGN, has signed an agreement to purchase power from a 40-megawatt solar farm being developed in Central Florida. Blue Chip Energy announced the deal. The power will come from the Sorrento Eagle Dunes Solar Farm, planned for Lake County, Florida. The 140-acre project will be built in phases, with 10 megawatts of capacity coming online in 2012. The second phase of 30 megawatts will come on later that year. When completed, the project will provide power sufficient for about 8,000 homes, Blue Chip says. The project is expected to cost $200 million to build. BioResource to build plant in China. BioResource International Incorporated, an agricultural biotechnology company based in Morrisville, plans to build a plant to produce natural feed additives in China. The company announced Tuesday that it has signed an agreement with Taiwan-based Yongzip Chemical Industrial Corporation Limited and Yongxin Pharmaceutical Corporation Limited to purchase the land and begin construction in Tiananmen, a city in Hubei Province, China. WakeMed North Hospital to rise. WakeMed Health and Hospitals will break ground on an expansion of the WakeMed North Healthplex and transform it into Wake County's fifth hospital, WakeMed North Hospital. The 90,000-square-foot addition is estimated to cost $62 million. The hospital plans to begin construction this fall and open the addition in October 2013. Construction of the North Hospital is predicted to create 500 construction jobs and will increase the current 150 hospital employees to 442 full-time equivalent employees by the second year of operation, with an average salary of $48,760, according to the hospital. And we have one more article we'll read as much of as we have time for. The headline on this article, Investor Rules Shifts Mulled. This is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. Tentative moves by the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission to liberalize the rules governing the sale of shares in private companies are being cheered by Triangle business people, who say raising growth capital would be easier. It's about time, says Raleigh attorney Tony Gaeta, whose firm Gaeta and Eveson structures the share offerings for bank clients. In fact, it's way overdue. The SEC has not yet issued a formal set of reform proposals for reaction. Even so, Chairman Mary Schapiro recently sparked a wave of comment in the financial world by saying changes under consideration would, among other things, lift the cap on a number of shareholders private companies can have before requiring them to follow stricter financial reporting standards. Right now, they can't have more than 499. How far the cap would be raised hasn't been stated. Make it easier for private firms to publicize share offerings. The SEC, which usually examines rule changes for months before taking action, has the authority to amend the regulation of private offering without getting congressional approval. The way I look at it, anything that would make raising money easier would be a good thing, says David Kirkpatrick, one of the founders of Durham-based Sustainable Jobs Fund, SJF, a venture group that invests in private green and clean tech firms. Kirkpatrick hastens to add a caveat, however. It would be a good thing as long as investors are protected, he said. Investors taking part in these deals are accredited investors, and I think it should remain that way. Expected to receive a... And actually, we'll stop there because we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long until next time.